Okay. Good.
It is kind of morning. I know it's Saturday. We all know, yes, too much raving going on last night, or too much chatting with the homeless guys around the corner. They were actually really friendly yesterday. When I got my car around midnight, a couple of homeless guys were chatting me up and they wanted to know what we were doing here. And I was like, sex and technology. And they were really interested more in the sex than in the technology, I guess. But it was a nice chatting with a couple of locals here. Okay, so it's the third day of Ars Electronica, the conference for Screw It Yourself. And this year we have the wonderful theme of identity, the entity and the identity in general. Ars Electronica is dealing with sex and technology because humans are a sexual species and a tool-using species, and that's so ingrained into our being that, of course, sex is defining technology and technology is defining sex. So that's the general theme of Ars Electronica. We've been doing it for 7 years, which is really cool. I hope we'll do it another 3 or 4 or 5 or many, 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 many years. The cool thing is, Christoph Peres was talking about that yesterday as part of his keynote presentation, that of course there's a lot of changing, and we have been feeling the change in the last 7 years. So 7 years ago, there was no discussion about the death of porn. In 2013, the death of porn is imminent. But not the porn as a concept, but mainstream porn as we know it. The concept of a DVD is that media, so there will be new forms of porn out there. And the exciting part is and that's what I'm really interested in, is that porn and pretty much all cultural production is in a certain form going a really interesting form of niche and finding its niche. And that's quite interesting to find out that so many people out there with technology like an iPhone, it's pretty much possible to shoot porn. You just need iPhone and a couple of friends, and there you have it. It doesn't mean that I advertise the iPhone. I'm actually pretty happy that Steve Jobs is gone. But what can you do? Because yeah, now that Steve Jobs is gone, the chance for Apple dying is actually getting bigger. That's why I like it. Yeah. So okay. So why are we doing Ars Electronica? Well, yes. Yeah. I run a conference on female orgasm. So what? I block cock. Yeah. There is always a reason why people should do more conferences and more discourse and more action about sex and technology and debate the big questions that are just like lingering out there, loitering actually. The first speaker is actually loitering right there, doing something on his. What is it actually? What do you have? What device do you have there?
It's a throwaway that I got at home,
It's
actually.
a burner phone. Is it a burner
It's
phone?
intended to be a burner, but it turns out it works on my like SIM card, so.
Okay. So I hope that you're partially defining yourself over your technology. I really like that.
Thanks for using me as the second of that.
Yes. I mean, I really have to say, being a German, I'm not German, I'm Austrian, but I speak German, like cock and it's strange idioms, I have to say, very strange. But they're okay. Let's see. You will be talking aesthetics, by the way. Aesthetics is his name. Male-bodied, nice hacker friend of ours for a long time. You were visiting or like paying attention to Ars Electronica for a long, long, long time. Also because of you were connected or still are connected, I guess, with Noisebridge and that kind of stuff, the local hacker scene. And I was really happy when this year you actually applied a talk and said like, I want to talk about the Nimbors. And a big applause for Aesthetics, the first speaker of the third day of Ars Electronica 2013.
So let's plug you in.
I feel like compelled to talk about chickens and cats or something after that picture. Right, can you guys all see that?
So it should be, yeah, there it is. Yep.
All right. Can you guys see this okay? All right, cool. So thanks to all the people who showed up for the first talk of the day. It's like just barely waking up myself. I understand how difficult it is. There's probably coffee down the street if you need it. Also, before I start, I just wanted to make sure everyone gives a big round of applause to Johannes and Ars Electronica, because it's really hard to put events like this together.
And Günther was sitting in the back doing all the tech stuff. Yeah, you can't see him, but there he is.
All right, yeah. Thank you to Günther, too. Yeah. Let's see. And just a note, I've been speaking on identity-related topics. I'm really happy for this conference because it's actually sex-focused and sex-oriented. There's a lot of stuff that I can't talk about in some forums I go to, like government-y stuff, because they just can't handle it. And I'll give an example of that in a second. But also, is this being recorded?
Yes.
Okay, because that changes what I'll say.
But we can, you know, like, censor
it. Okay. It depends whether I name names or not. Often depends on whether it's recorded. So actually, first question: does anybody recognize this slide, like the image? Okay. There you go. Because I did a talk in Holland at a conference called OHM a couple months ago, and the talk title was The Secret of NIM, like NYM for pseudonym and such, and nobody there understood it, because apparently that was relevant in Europe about 20 years ago. Like, everyone here got it, but I was giving the talk in Europe, so you know, sometimes there's context issues there. And I just want to share a quick story before I get into this, because I'm really happy to be able to talk about sex. So I'm involved in this thing, and I'll get to it more at the end. It's a government initiative called the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, aka NSTIC or NISTIC. And they had this thing that we're trying to do use cases, like, why would somebody use identity? And I was talking with a number of friends, and we're trying to get more of what's considered the subcultures and alternative cultures into it, because it's a bunch of, like, older, balding white guys from Northern Virginia, and I'm like, fuck you, you're not telling me what I can and cannot do online. And so we submitted a use case called adult viewing, specifically to see, well, maybe we can sneak a discussion about porn into this somehow. So the guys actually took that, and they changed the use case name to age-restricted content, step one. And then step two, they began to turn it, instead of a narrative about porn and the adult industry, it turned into a narrative about protecting children on Facebook from predators. So that's the, see how the evolution of that, because it's technically the same thing and ultimately the general paradigm is the same, but they couldn't even address the notion of sex. And that's kind of what I've been dealing with. So it's really great to have an audience that's actually open to talking about this stuff. All right, so did anybody see this? I like to open with stories usually. So This was a really twisted story too. Stacey Halas, I think, or Halas, I don't know how to pronounce the name. So I want to say 2005, 2006, she was having some issues with money, and she wound up doing, I think, porn for maybe 6 months or something like that. Nothing super big, just enough to get, you know, go on by and such. So fast forward a few years, and she is a teacher, and specifically it's a school in California. And this is where context and boundaries and such comes into play, because as a teacher, she was doing, you know, a typical teacher job. I think she was teaching biology, and one of her students then wound up on the internet discovering her past. And anybody guess how that turned out? Right. So basically what happened was some students found it, and then they brought it to other teachers and the principal and so on and so forth. The other thing that was actually kind of weird is that students, in addition to discovering this, started actually vandalizing her room, like leaving graffiti on the windows and things like that. And it was somehow okay to do that, but not to address this taboo topic. So the teacher, I can't remember the specific words that were used, but they basically found that she was unfit to continue teaching. Or something like that. She was no longer in the capacity to teach these children. She was not able to hold the quote-unquote authority over them or something like that. So I just like using this example because somebody with obviously two names, and maybe one of them doesn't even exist anymore, the Tiffany Six character there. But it's what happens when we take, say, something which is socially taboo, and then this is why context dependency is important, is what I'm getting at. You have two different paradigms and such. Has anybody run into issues like this before, by the way? Okay, I'm seeing some nodding. Yeah, one of the challenges with talking about this stuff is that a lot of people who have separate identities or separate names, as we'll get into the difference in a second, have it for a reason. Therefore, when you're trying to discuss things like this publicly, well, they can't actually bring up themselves as an example or somebody else as an example because that compromises somebody's privacy. There's all the taboo, which is based on cultural fear and such. So before I get any closer, before I get deeper into this, because the question, a lot of people say identity, and I've been to a lot of identity conferences where people don't even seem to have an agreement on what the definition of the word identity is, I think it's first important to say that names are not the same thing as identity. So on the left side there, does anybody recognize these pictures, by the way? On the left, it's Adam naming the animals from Genesis. And if you guys recall at all, Adam in the Garden of Eden is naming the animals because by doing so it creates almost a power dynamic of sorts because he creates the labels for the animals. And then later on you have the Tower of Babel where God, or I think it was Jehovah, Yahweh, whatnot, Old Testament God, evil, vicious dude, comes and basically casts everyone into different languages. And by doing that, he ruptures the dialogue and basically takes back the power that they were using to try to reach him. So things to consider as we talk about names more. And on the right, you have the royal seal, which is basically kind of an authentication verification thing, but kind of relevant here. But the most important thing is that a name and a label are not, or I'm sorry, a name and identity are not the same thing. I would say a name might be an attribute of identity, and there are many different types of identity attributes, and we'll get into that more in a minute. So I'm defining here a name is a label or symbol that's used to identify a person, thing, or concept within a given context. And the use of the phrase symbol is important right there because that accounts for things like Prince, when Prince changed his name to that little symbol thing to get around the recording industry issues. So these are just some issues to think about. So various nom de plume. A nom de plume is kind of a beautiful thing. It literally means feather name, as in, like, you know, the quill, the feather and the quill when you're writing a pen name and such. So does anybody recognize Publius? The name Publius was tossed around a lot when Nim Wars happened. What's that? Not Ender's Game, but Ender's Game is a fun example to use, too. So Publius was the name that was used by the three authors of the Federalist Papers. And when they were trying to get the Constitution ratified, it was John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison, I think. And they were trying to ratify the Constitution, which replaced the Articles of Confederation and made a strong central federal government. And they ran into a lot of issues, and they were writing these letters to the editor anonymously, or pseudonymously, I should say, using the name Publius, because that way the baggage of their names and their identities would not get attached to it, and people were able to look at the content without the bias. So the next year is J.K. Rowling. Anybody know why that's a pseudonym? So the answer, she didn't want to be identified as female to boys who were reading Harry Potter. It's actually worse than that. So there's no... What's that? There was a thing with the editor, but specifically her name is Joan Rowling. She doesn't have a middle name. And K was just something they kind of added in because the editors didn't think that a woman publishing would be able to sell to a young audience. And there's actually a few examples of that. Nicholas Bourbaki is a fun one. Any math geeks in the house? Nicholas Bourbaki was a group of French mathematicians in the 1920s and 30s. It was kind of a secret society type thing. They decided to rewrite mathematics from the ground up. And this is one of my favorites. Anybody know this one? Ian Donald Calvin Euclid Zappa? Do you? Okay. Yes. Okay, how many people here heard of Frank Zappa? Okay, yeah. Well, except for you, but I guess you're sheltered. Oh, no? Okay. So Frank Zappa had two kids that are of note. One of them is Moon Unit and the other is Dweezil. So this was actually Dweezil's birth name. What happened was Frank Zappa and his wife were at the hospital and they gave birth to Dweezil. And the nurse is like, okay, what name do you want to go on the birth certificate? And they said Dweezil. And the nurse said, no, use a real name. So they just like made this shit up and put it on the kid's birth certificate. So fast forward 5 years, Dweezil's like five, and they've been calling him Dweezil all along, and then he discovers this thing is on his birth certificate, and at the age of five, they actually legally changed his name to Dweezil. So that's just a fun little history fact. A couple others here. This is Richard Bachman, a.k.a. Stephen King. Deep Throat, a.k.a. Mark Felt, basically the Watergate whistleblower stuff. Volterra, the political dissident, a.k.a. Candide and such. He was writing political dissidents, and he didn't want to get murdered by the King of France, who wanted to put a hit on the person who wrote Candide. There's also George Eliot and the Bronte sisters. The Bronte sisters, they were published under male names because they couldn't get published as females. And in fact, it seems like there's a lot of women who were trying to write, and they couldn't get published. There's so many that there's actually a Wikipedia page for it, which is specifically female writers who wrote under male or gender-neutral pseudonyms. So this gives you an idea why this stuff is so important. I mean, this is just some of it. This is just getting into some of the gender dynamics, but there's a hell of a lot more to it than this. Let's see. So why do names matter? And before I get into this, I want to touch briefly on nemoirs because we did, I think Johannes mentioned it in the introduction. Does everybody know what I mean when I say nemoirs?
Huh.
What? Sure. So Nimwars was way back in summer of 2011. Google rolls out Google Plus, and a lot of us are like, sweet, because we all want Facebook to die. And then Google Plus came along, and you know, we started using it, and then people started getting suspended for the names that they were using. And there's all kinds of political melodrama that went into that, and it turned into this thing that was called the Nimwars, where a bunch of people who got suspended came out and said, hey, this is my name, I've been using this for many years, and Google's like, well, no, you have to use your real name. And they didn't really seem to know what that actually was, and there's all kinds of back and forth, and this is what happens when engineers run the world, I guess. And that's kind of something that's persisted over time, and they're still doing this, by the way. I know a few people who've been suspended within the last 6 months, and sometimes it's just a bureaucratic mess-up. Sometimes maybe somebody hit regex on the website, and it just suspended them, and they got it unsuspended. I know somebody who's a sex worker right now who was suspended, and she, I think, is in her fourth appeal at the moment. So it's an ongoing problem, and I don't know whether it's targeted or not. There's actually a project that I'm working on to try to catalog all these. So that gives some context for how we came into this. And remember that Nim Wars is about battle. It's about basically fighting. Whereas Nim Rights, as you see on the upper right, is something that we came up with as an enabling, an educational tool. So we'll cover that more in the end. So in terms of why names matter, generally comes down to the fundamental question of attribution. So who can tell me what this is? The picture. Printing press, good. And who can tell me what was the first book ever printed on the printing press?
Generally known as the Bible.
Generally known as the Bible, yeah, any number of the variants of it. And who knows what the second most popular book on the printing press was? Close! 95 Theses. And because there's two interesting things that the printing press does. One is it solves the distribution problem, because instead of somebody making 20 copies by hand, you make a single copy. It might take a little bit longer, but then you stick it in the printing press, and a whole bunch can print it out. And this causes a lot of issues when you think of institutions like the Catholic Church, which are trying to hold their stronghold on the world, and then people actually begin thinking for themselves, and then there's the question of, well, do your ideas come from God or they come from you, and so on and so forth. But within attribution, there's two sides of it. There's reputation, which we're having a lot of issues with right now. How do you know somebody is worth a salt? How should I trust that Yelp review? Things like that. And on the flip side, there's accountability. If somebody commits a crime, what can I do about this? And these are the two biggest things that we're dealing with online identity issues right now. Let's say somebody is using Tor or an anonymizing browser feature or something like that, and they commit a crime, whether it be child porn or, you know, Bitcoin trafficking. And, well, what do you do? And, I mean, there's the other problem that the average age of Congress is 65, and they don't have a fucking clue how any of this works, but that's another story. So these are all things that are really important to consider, and if you look at identity at all, you'll run into attribution over and over and over again. And I said I was going to come back to identity, because it's not the same thing as names. In fact, I would suggest that identity is a much deeper, much more involved concept. So how many of you know Carl Jung? Oh, sweet. Okay. Government people don't at all. They're so fucking bad. So Jung has these two ideas that are kind of adapted from Freud, the ego and the, what is it, the in-ego. Jung kind of adapts this out into the conscious, which is what I have here, the math, logic, the reason, and set theory, and so on, the symbols that you use to communicate. And then beneath that, you have the unconscious, which is basically emotion and feelings and things which are not definable, yet still can be communicated in some ways. And if you think about it, what is a word? What is a name, right? Name is a label or symbol. A name is basically a word. So when I say the word like happy, happy means something different to everyone in here. It may be context dependent, may be dependent on history, things like that. But if you think about conscious as being the word and the unconscious as being kind of the definition of the word, or the feelings that it conjures, things like that, not easily definable, think about this as somebody hears a name that they don't recognize. Think about this as somebody, are they going to feel trapped? Do they feel like it's something that they can belong to? Is this name that they hear or these words that they hear within the nomenclature of what they're used to? And therefore, could it be considered a real name? And another interesting question, and we'll get into this more in a minute, is where do we get these concepts of what is real and what isn't? So coming out of that a little bit, where we had that yin-yang that we were just using for the Jungian stuff, where you have the black and the white, and you spin it, and it turns gray because everything is actually gray. The question here is, well, what does identity mean, and how can we map it out? And I actually created this diagram to explain it to computer scientists because I was getting sick of these computer systems like Google and Facebook and such being, like, atrociously bad. So I have kind of the label here. Labels help to define relationships. So instead of having a document that your name is plastered on and that document controlling you, which is the diagram we'll get into in a minute, instead here I have all these different social networking things. So you have like Twitter, Facebook, and driver's license, and family and friends, and it's split into the different, I have like A, B, C, D, defining what these relationships are. And I'm using a name because we've defined a name as a label. So if you use it as a label to define a relationship, well, it turns out that maybe you have a relationship with Twitter or you have a relationship with Facebook, and the name is basically the symbol that you use to communicate back and forth. And the nice thing about using a relationship to define this is that relationships are generally two-dimensional, or they're two-way. And when you have a relationship, you can build things on top of it, like trust and like consent. And those are not really existent in the world right now for the network things that we have. Another thing I want to point out here, so there's actually a lot of stuff into this diagram. I probably don't have time to get into it and all, but you have the driver's license right there, the government-issued ID. Well, that's number C. And number D, notice it says Jack is derived from John Smith, Jack on relationship D. The etymological word for a nickname is actually an additional name. So it actually makes sense that you could have somebody whose legal name is John, but everyone, the friends and family, all call them Jack, and it actually works into the diagram a bit. The way that Google has been doing this, I don't know about Facebook, but the way that Google has done this is they have created this thing where you can have a persona, and I think you can have like up to four or something like that, and it has first name, was it, quote, nickname, unquote, last name, or is it first name, last name, and parentheses, nickname, or something like that? You can choose which way.
Your nickname is
presented on Google. Yeah, and they added all that in after I stopped using it. I haven't used Google in about 2 years, except in some rare cases where I've had to. But it kind of defeats the whole point of having multiple contexts. So this is kind of a big takeaway, and I designed this hopefully that people will take that and build something with it. And the other reason that I have that there is because we can then go back and define what a NIM is based on all of this. Now, normally when I say NIM, I say it's short for pseudonym, and people understand that because everyone has been hearing the word pseudonym a lot lately. Part of it's because of the privacy discussions that have been going on. However, there's actually quite a few of these, and people use NIMs and they don't even realize it. So, for example, you have a pseudonym, which is a name that's used to hide a base name. And that's really an important distinction because that means that there are two names. There's the base name, which is usually considered somebody's legal name or quote-unquote real name, and then there's the pseudonym, which is kind of hiding it. If you think about this, the physical sense of this, if you wear a mask, like a mask could be a physical pseudonym, and that gets really interesting because a lot of cities have anti-mask laws now. I discovered this during Occupy. Beyond that, you have a polynym, so that's consistent of multiple words or symbols, so that'd be like John Smith, and then a mononym, which is, you know, like aesthetics or just John. And an autonym is a name which is bestowed upon oneself. And an autonym is different from a pseudonym. And I've brought this into forums, and people just are totally shocked by this concept that you could have multiple base names, that you could have a name which is interdependent from a different name. Does anybody here have an autonym, by the way? Nobody has an autonym? A few? Okay. And an anonym is a name basically representing anonymity. It could be a name like Anonymous, which represents a group of people. It could be a name that's given to somebody who is a commenter who didn't log in on a web forum, like Slashdot has Anonymous Coward, things like that. So this is one of my favorite parts of the talks that I often do. Does anybody, you guys familiar with Joseph Campbell at all? It gets back into the Jungian stuff and some Joyce as well. So I'll start off with, has anybody here seen Star Wars? I always get laughs. What's that?
Which one?
Oh, yeah, which one? Yeah, the holiday special, right? So George Lucas actually credits Joseph Campbell on the hero's journey idea with a lot of the work that goes into it. And you can actually trace through like Luke Skywalker's journey and so on. Do you guys know the left-hand path and the right-hand path of the mythology? So Joseph Campbell was a famous mythologist. I think he passed away in 87, but he did a ton of brilliant work. I recommend looking up The Power of Myth and his interview with Bill Moyers and such. So he uses these terms, right-hand path and left-hand path, were actually very old concepts. They are based, I think they're Buddhist. The right-hand path is the institution which breeds you, maybe it's the community you come from. It's how you construct your ideology from outside. So I think I mentioned the Catholic Church before, or the U.S. government, or American culture, or all of these things. It's the way things are supposed to be. It's the way that you were brought up. It could be the corner store down the street. It could be the way that the city that you grew up in is laid out. It could be the way that people act. Do you bow or shake hands? What is the mannerism that you use? And the left-hand path is more your own independent journey as you travel through life. So you also see this with different words, like is it dexter and sinister? So I think dexter is right and sinister is left from the Latin. And if you think about it, where you get like the S and the snake and somebody is sinister, and this goes into the same notions where up until relatively recently, like maybe 100 years ago, somebody who was left-handed, like I'm left-handed, somebody who was left-handed would be told to write with their right hand because it was evil and sinister to be left. So these are kind of the mindsets that fall into all of this. But Campbell comes along and he rephrases the left-hand path as kind of the hero's journey. So I don't know how well you guys can see this, but I'll rattle it off. How much time do I have left, by the way?
Let's see.
I told you I tend to ramble, so.
Yeah. Like
20 minutes? 20 minutes? Okay, I think that should be good. So with the hero's journey, you have the call to action and it's hard to see on there. So you have the call to action, and then you go through all these different steps. And by the way, these vary based on who it is and what your journey is, and this is kind of a frame that he sort of put together. But there's a call to action, and then there is some kind of a threshold that you jump, that you stop being yourself and you become part of this adventure that goes through, and maybe you'll meet a mentor. So I think, was it Morpheus and then the Oracle or something like that in The Matrix, and Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars and so on? And you go through all these different challenges. Maybe you meet some friends along the way who help you. You know, so you get the orcs and the dwarves and everything else. And you go through a bunch of different challenges, and you hit the abyss, and you have all these battles, and maybe you have something where you beat the dragon, you go through sort of transformations, and at the very end you have the atonement, which is literally coming to be at one with yourself, taking all the lessons that you have learned on your journeys and putting them all back together, and then you come back to where you started. And just like Gulliver, everyone understands you, right? Or do you have trouble relating to people, or do you see things in a different way? Does this change the way that you look at the world? So I'll throw this quiz to the audience now. How do play parties work into this? What do you guys think? Any ideas?
What do you mean by play
party? Oh, like if you go to a sex party or something.
There might be a threshold.
There could be a threshold maybe, yeah. Ooh, I like that, yeah. So usually if you're new to the community, you're being introduced by way of some mentor, somebody to teach you the rules, or like Merlin with Arthur, things like that. Okay, I like that a lot, yeah. And it's a whole new set of boundaries you learn because you're not in a small town anymore, you're in the big city. And the big city, there's a bunch of people from a bunch of small towns and all of them have their own sets of boundaries. The other interesting thing here is that when you're on a hero's journey or whatever it is that you consider it to be, you have stepped outside of your typical frame and you're rebuilding a frame of reference around you and you, in a sense, have a beginner's mind. You are basically entering a play. So it's one of those whole all the world's a stage type things. And a play party is where you have these roles you assume, maybe you assume the role of a top or, you know, a dom or a sub or whatever else. I'm not even going to try to play with those labels because that gets complicated really fast. But if you consider these labels to be archetypes or if you consider them to be roles that you play and you jump into them, and sometimes you get better at them than others, which is why we have down here, we have the notion of persistent identity, which literally means if you have two contexts, it's an identity which persists across context. So it could be two play parties and you assume the same role and you go deeper and deeper into that role and become more attuned to what that role means and who you are and such. Or it could be I'm on Facebook and I have an identity there and then I have a Reddit identity or I have a Twitter identity. And my identity persists across those. And one of the things the government is trying to do is create a persistent identity for all of us online, which is one of the things, obviously, I'm trying to warn you all against. But if you go back to the slide that I had before, which shows the labels defining relationships and such, and the trust and the boundaries and consent and such, bring that back into this, and you can see why what the government and the internet websites are trying to do breaks down very quickly. Or, if you don't think it breaks down, perhaps they're not doing something benevolent after all. Perhaps there's something much more sinister going on, and maybe they're trying to undo the effects of the printing press, but that could just be a theory. So a couple of quick definitions. A social network I'm defining as a force that brings people or their personas together on a regular basis, and persona is an important term there. Persona could be your presence online. It could be an IRC name or something like that. A friend is a person that you would choose to be in contact with. And one of my favorites here, an institution is a custom practice relationship or significant behavior with a pattern within a social network. Because gay people are evil, right? And where do we get these ideas? This is one of my favorite slides, and this is a huge barrier I've had to work to break down with people, because I get this all the time, what's your real name, or don't you have a real name, or something like that, because it doesn't fit into their lexicon, but before I get into this, by the way, there's two actual definitions of real that I get into here, and one of them is people often mistake it for your legal name, or the name on your driver's license, or such, and the other is the name that you are known by in real life, and a lot of people have difficulty with that. But the one that's you're called in real life actually holds a lot of weight, because if you think about it, if you go to court, for example, and the judge asks you to sign in, you're not showing your ID. You're saying, yes, I attest I am who I am, and maybe you do it under oath, maybe you sign a document. But there's no reason to show them your name, and yet the judge considers it to be real. So, quick question, what's the opposite of real?
Imaginary?
Mad? Oh. Fake. Okay, that's what I was looking for. I don't know, I think imaginary can be real, but... So there's a lot of negative implications to anything that is not real, right? If it's fake, or it's if you have the binary viewpoint, then it's good and bad, true and false, and so on. The other thing here is you have a lack of agency. How many people here gave yourself the name that's on your government-issued ID? Occasionally we get that. Yeah. And it's also just, there's so many better ways to do this. And instead of real, it's kind of a cop-out, but what if you say legal name? What if that's a name granted by law that the legal body has said, yes, it's okay to have this, even if you're a Hawaiian person who has a last name that's longer than 40 characters, or somebody who just had that issue happen with them. There's also birth name, the name you were given at birth. Even though you don't have a choice over it, it's still your birth name. Or maybe you do. There's also given name, and that isn't just the name your parents gave you. It could be names that your friends give you and so on. You could have multiple given names. So there's many, many substitutions and many alternatives. And anybody have a guess of where this comes from, the notion of real name? There's a lot of different places that I've found. The earliest I have found is, I think, in the 1200s. It was Henry II of England, as they were trying to unify English under common law, because before they basically had a bunch of hobbit shires that were around, and they were trying to, well, how do we enforce law over all this stuff? And this concept of having a quote-unquote real name that the king could use to identify you and thus carry out orders, property taxes, things like that, came into being. What? Inheritance, yes. Okay, and you have a British accent of some sort.
No, I
didn't. Oh, okay, that sounded like you did. I was going to say. Other places this comes from is the Reformation, when the Catholic Church began writing down the names of all the babies that were baptized because they wanted to tell who was a true believer and who was a heretic, aka a Protestant. Other places it comes from the discovery of the New World, where the kings began to write down the names of the people who were living in the new colonies so that they could keep track of it all. So there's a lot of interesting nuance to all of this, and unfortunately a lot of it is lost to the ages. There's an interesting talk, if you're interested more in the history of this, called What is in a Name? It was done at 28C3 Chaos Computer Congress a couple years ago, and that's where I got some of those ideas from. But the guy, I think it's Christoph Engmann, did a whole bunch of really good research, and I recommend it. What is in a Name? So I promised you guys that I would show you what I call Google's method. You can tell I maybe made this out of spite to Google. So before we had the method of what I call my method because I created it, wherein or it's kind of a spectrum more. This is much more of a top-down hierarchical model. So at the very top you have more legitimate, at the bottom you have less legitimate. So by the way, legitimate comes from Latin legitimare, which is to make lawful. So if you look at law as the structure is the right-hand path that you have to fit into and whatnot, and at the top you have the real name or the government-issued ID or the driver's license, and lower down on the, I mean, you could look at this as, you know, first class, second class, you could look at that as aristocracy and the proles, you could look at this as all kinds of different hierarchical issues. The interesting thing here is, well, the thing down below, labels give someone else power over you, meaning that the higher up it gets, the less likely you are to have given yourself that label. And the lower it gets, well, the more freedom that you have there, however, the less legitimacy it has. And in all of these cases, usually somebody else will determine what it is. A number of other issues that come up, and these are things I could ramble about for a long time, but I'm going to get cut off soon, I imagine. So first off, there's the binary gender. So does everyone here know what I mean when I say binary gender? By which I mean male, female on a website, like Facebook or something like that. The interesting thing, correct me if I'm wrong, but something like Google and Facebook, I believe they allow you to create a persona, but they don't allow you to have different genders assigned to them. Is that correct? Okay. Which is funny because maybe somebody has personas for different genders, and that's never taken into account. By the way, does anybody know the picture on the right here? This was on Reddit a few years ago. Do you guys know who that is? That would be President FDR. Yeah. And this is really interesting because I think the dress was pink, too, because this was before, I think it was post-war, that pink and blue got assigned to gender-wise. And given that FDR is wearing a dress, that's girly, isn't it? Except that dresses are actually practical for babies as they grow older, and it's a white, pinkish dress, which means you can bleach it. So it turns out there's a lot of practicalities to all of this. And in fact, when you take a look at the gender stereotypes we have today, and what I call here the curse of the nuclear family, because the nuclear family doesn't actually work at all if you think about it deeply. Yeah, it's fucked up, because if you think about it, I had this realization that feminism and the nuclear family cannot coexist and have a successful, thriving community, because if you think about it, you have the nuclear family, which is a father, a mother, and then, you know, 2.5 kids out in a picket fence. Well, with feminism, that allows women equal rights, which means that women can go out and work, and suddenly you have two people working, and where do the kids go? Do they go off to daycare? And suddenly somebody else is raising them, and it breaks down everything. It makes a lot more sense if we got away with the nuclear family model, because, well, if women are supposed to stay home and raise the kids, then what are the grandparents going to do? And if you have people who are able-bodied and able to work, why not have them out in the fields with everyone else? Because that's how it used to be. And then there's the notion of these family units, and then the whole... Do I have time to go on a rant, actually? What?
A rant left.
A rant what? Okay. How about if somebody wants to hear that rant, come up to me afterwards, but there's a lot to that. And I just want to touch on the bias within names. There was actually a case that came up at this guy. I can't remember his last name. His name was Kim something or other. And he was applying for like tech work or something, and his resume kept getting rejected over and over again. He added the words Mr. to the front of it, and then sure enough, it comes out. And there's actually a lot of research into not only like gender biases, but there's also race biases. So if you have a name that looks like it's African American or a minority of any sort, then there's a disparity between what gets accepted and what doesn't. So I told you a whole bunch of stuff, and if you agree with me, I haven't gotten tomatoes yet, so hopefully you do. We have this organization called NIMRIGHTS. It's NYMRIGHTS.org, and anybody can be a member. You don't even have to be a U.S. citizen. And what we're trying to do, it's basically this government initiative that I mentioned at the very beginning, where they're trying to create some kind of an overarching online identity policy, and I'm trying to get people involved who can, if, at the very least, vote against bad things. And we're trying to craft our own identity policy. Like, I'm calling it a NIM positive policy. The reason being, instead of just telling Facebook and Google and all these new sites that, well, your policy sucks, you shouldn't do that, it's much easier to give them a choice and be like, well, here, why don't you take a look at this one and see which works better for you? And if you decide that the other one works, well, we try at least. And it's something that we can do that's positive. And I also have this, I'm calling it the Suspended Project. If you go to NIMRIGHTS.org, where I'm beginning to chronicle a list of people who have been suspended by online services, and it's not just Google. And let's see, there's a study that we have coming up that we're working on. I'm crafting it with my friends at MIT, where we're actually creating a Google Apps account, wherein somebody can use a NIM within that account. And there's some interesting nuances to it, because it turns out that a company that is using a Google App policy, well, a company needs to be able to set their own policies. So if we create a company and set our own names policy to it, we're going to see what happens. So if you guys are interested, let me know, because we're looking for people to participate. And finally, I have a bunch of info cards with me, which are just basic, what's a NIM, how does this stuff work, and the intended audience is somebody who's never sent an email. So with that, I think I'm about to get kicked off, but does anybody have any questions?
Oh, yeah, please. We usually, I would say, grab that microphone from the stand. I'll have that one.
We have 40 questions. So you grab that one, just put it on the thing.
So because we're recording the whole thing, and it would actually be better to see you. People in the recording can hear the question. So if you have a question, please come here, and I'll hand you the microphone.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, this is short. I was just going to say, if you want your daughter to succeed in the technical world, it helps a lot if she has a gender-neutral name. Because if you look at Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina and go right down the list, you don't make it through the... I've talked to a number of women with technical degrees, and they go to the bottom of the stack. When they apply for graduate school, they just slip out the bottom of the stack. And it's just amazing how persistent that is.
Yeah, and there's also the issue of like meets like, where somebody's going to look for something that matches what they can identify with, which is why Silicon Valley looks the way it does right now. People tend to not want to step outside of the boundaries that they know. So, but absolutely.
And then another thing I had happen, I had a friend who was a TV announcer in Hawaii, and his last name did not sound very white, and they ordered him to change his name for being on air. So that gets tricky.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of Indian tech workers that are doing tech support for American companies are using names like, I think, Sean Parker and whatever else that sound American. And you talk to them and you're like, I know you have a different name. Like, you just cop this so that I'll feel more comfortable. But yeah, because names totally don't matter. That's the whole Ellis Island and everything. Any other questions? Comments?
The almost Brit.
So earlier you had a slide talking about the different NIMs. That was an awesome slide, by the way. I really appreciated that. And I had a question. Can a pseudonym also be an antonym, and aren't they often? Those aren't mutually exclusive, correct? Just so I
correct.
Get the slide right.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's all I need to know.
Yeah. It's just like archetypes and just like roles. All of this stuff is very fluid, and something which is a NIM could be like something which is an autonym could become somebody's legal name. It can float back and forth.
Yeah. For a lot of people who are already like, you know, in Facebook, or they've already bowed down to Google Plus or whatever, a lot of what keeps them going there is they have a lot of inertia. They've already invested. They're like, oh, I've had my Facebook account since I was, you know, a wee lad. And so what would you recommend for them to kind of overcome this inertia and, you know, express or, you know, to ways to drop that account or change those things or things like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first I would say that you can't make anybody else do anything. And if somebody wants to, then offer a helping hand. You know, like I'm doing with the NIM policies, show them that there are alternatives. And there are, although Facebook is a bit tricky, there's a whole bunch of nuance to that. And a lot of people just blindly go through not even thinking about this stuff at all, and it's not until something costs them. So, for example, they click on something and there's a privacy issue that happens. So the example I've used here is somebody is using privacy filters to explore alternative sexuality, and then their parents see it, and then they freak out, and they're like, what do I do, what do I do? And it's not until something like that happens that people begin to become more aware. And once somebody is aware, then they're asking questions. And you can't answer a question somebody hasn't asked. So unfortunately, you can't. It's one of those, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And I want to like work to create a framework and guidelines so that people who are looking for these things can find them. And you'd be amazed the time people who are looking and they just haven't said anything because it's taboo.
Well, but then also, you know, you could work at...
But so, and that works for the people who've encountered this friction mm-hmm. and then are trying to get around it. But for the totally normative people, it seems like that's the root of the problem. Because if you can get them to be more aware of this stuff before, you know, they potentially encounter these situations, then it becomes more normal, and the people who do need these access are already in this framework or space.
Right. No, absolutely good point. And so there's a few answers to that. One of them is with this alternative NIM policy that we're working on. If we can get small websites to adapt it, then over time it might become something people see on occasion and become familiar with it, so it creates that token of notion. I mean, that's why we have a logo for NIM Rights, for example, because people can see that and becomes familiar. Also, looking at the concerns people have and like finding the legs of the table and attacking them before they actually come up. So one of the big criticisms that NIMs get is, well, don't people use them to be pedophiles online? So the appropriate response to that is I've been starting to reach out to law enforcement to see if there are ways that we can work together and have a discussion, because if there are, in fact, bad things happening, I want to work with people who are in a position of authority to do something. And once that happens, if you get a notion of who people's authoritative figures are, and you go to, say, law enforcement, or you go to school teachers and things like that, this safe harbors of society, if they're okay with it, and if you can teach them, and it's a very slow, gradual process, but that's basically how you change a paradigm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's no easy answer to this, but there's little things you could chip away at and over time kind of move the glacier. Any other questions? Those are good.
Wonderful. Excellent.
No pedophile questions. I'm disappointed.
Should I? What? No, I won't.
No, I won't drink your Bud Light.
No.
Or, no, you can't have my Bud Light. That's what it is.
Yeah, but because you asked, your question was if I have my defined name in my legal documents or something like that. Yeah, the story is that I have a second name which I don't like. And what happened was when I went to the passport services in Austria, the officer went out during my process of filling out all the forms and stuff like that, and he was transcribing my long name from my birth certificate, and then he was going out to take a leak. And what I did is I wiped out my middle name with whiteout he had on the desk. And that's why in my passport there is only my first and my last name and not my middle name. And it works.
Yeah.
So, and now the world knows it. Yes.
By the way, I just want to pivot off that. Ed Snowden, when they filed the extradition request to get him from Hong Kong, it turned out that the person who filed it left his middle name off of it, which is why he was able to escape to Russia. You would think that they would have that, but no. They fucked it up. There's that too, huh?
Oh, yeah, wonderful. Aesthetics, a big applause.
Right,
clap, clap. Wonderful. And we are almost again on schedule, so it's perfect.
Against all odds.
Yes. So that means without much ado.